नमो तस्स भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा सम्बुद्धस्स नमो तस्स भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा सम्बुद्धस्स नमो तस्स भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा सम्बुद्धस्स बुद्धं धम्मं संघं नमस्सामि. This retreat, the opportunity to look in a quite constantly and to develop that awareness around the body and the conditions of the mind. In order to be able to see things in terms of Dhamma. So in contrast the word Dhamma with the word self, because the self view is a conditioned one. That's how we think. That's our thinking mind is in, we think in terms of me and mine and I am. So, the self is what's conditioned into us. We aren't born with it. We aren't born thinking, but we have language and the society and the culture and so forth. And still has a sense of I am. So that's why in contemplating things in terms of Dhamma, you're changing from the I am to this is the way it is, the way it is. But it's very important to know the difference, because I find that whenever you term things, whenever you even think I am, then there's a whole kind of a logical sequence and habits that go along with that assumption, I am. Dhamma is the way things are, so that's why we take refuge in the Buddha, the Dhamma, the Sangha, rather than in, the Buddha would never use the term like the Atman or anything relating to self. He used anatta, non-self, I think as a skillful means to break away from even seeing the in terms of a big self and a little self, or an over self, or an ultimate self and a temporary self. So we take refuge in Dhamma, which is the way, the truth of the way it is. Now the I am is a conventional reality. It doesn't mean that we should never think I am or use that way of speaking. It has its practicalities, and conventional communication is phrased in that way. You can't expect to go out into the society and talk about the Dhamma and not refer to yourself in some way through I am or me and mine. But in reflecting on the way it is, then you have this opportunity to see that this illusion of I am, that feeling of being a person, a personality, an individual, because mindfulness taken to as ultimate is universal. It's one, it's not personal. When we're fully aware and attentive, then that purity of awareness is not personal. The personal stuff comes up when you start thinking. Going back to the old habits of, if you start thinking, I am aware, then you're back into the into the realm of I am. But there is this awareness, this silence, this purity, there's this intelligence. It's like this. This is the Dhamma, this is the way it is. Then to see the conditions that you're experiencing, such as the thoughts and emotions and feelings, mental states that you experience, you're looking at them now as Dhamma rather than as personal problems, personal attributes. Because when contemplating the anicca dukkha anatta, it's a skillful means the Buddha devised to be able to get to some perspective on the things that we generally hold on to and identify and are habituated to, addicted to. The reflection, sabbe sankharani cha, all conditions are impermanent. That's something you can, contemplate the rest of your life. Then you'll develop increasing wisdom just by using that one phrase, sabbe sankharani cha, all conditions are impermanent. Then you contemplate conditions. What do we mean by conditions? Or sankharas? And they say all conditions are impermanent. So you through the five khandhas, you use that example of the five aggregates, the consciousness, through the eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, and mind, through the body, the human body, the feelings, the perceptions, the volitional tendencies, proliferations of the mind, the sankharas, are conditions. So even when we look at the sun, we can see that the sun is a condition, because we can see it as an object. The moon is a condition, the stars are conditions. We look far away. But you can even close your eyes and see conditions. Recognize the conditions of thought and feeling, emotion, liking and disliking, wanting and not wanting. And so we ask ourselves, what is it that is aware of all this? What is it that contemplates, that can notice, that can reflect upon the condition? Is that a condition? Can one condition contemplate another condition? Now, thinking then is we attach to ideas and thoughts, and we can fool ourselves that we think we can actually figure everything out with logic, with reason. So there is a kind of conceit that human beings have, especially modern, educated human beings, that we have a feeling that we can figure it all out because we can use our reasoning mind to do so. Plenty of books on this, that people write out, and theses in university libraries, and all kinds of things on the origin of the universe and nature of existence and the ultimate reality and metaphysical speculations of philosophies, physics, and various sciences, all quite brilliant in the ability to expound using symbols, forms, and logic accordingly. But the thing is that it in itself is conditioning, isn't it? Language, logic, reason, all symbols, all images are conditioned. Which doesn't mean to say, doesn't mean in, to imply any kind of dismissal of them, or say because they are, they're not worth bothering with. Not, we're not trying to dismiss life or the world, but to get perspective on it, to be able to see it in the right way. So that's what meditation is for, being able to change direction from just being caught up into through the habits, the assumptions that we have already. We stop. We stop just following those, and we start reflecting. So this is the, like the Buddha seeing the Dhamma, the refuge in Buddha, the refuge in Dhamma. What is it all about? What are the five khandhas? We start pondering, wondering, contemplating. And we're not just seeing it in terms of logic and reason, figure it out, there's definitions, but what is it? Vijnana, now is an experience. What is sanya? What is now? You know, not just getting a nice definition from the Pali dictionary. Feeling. Where does the word, words like emotion fit into these five khandhas? What is attraction? What is aversion? And so forth. So we reflect and contemplate. And we're looking at these, we're beginning to notice the real thing that they're referring to in this body here, this consciousness that we call me and mine, that we say is mine. Then the pattern, the anicca, all that is subject to arise, subject to ceasing, sape sangharanicca, all sape tama anatta, all dhamma is anatta, not self. All dhamma, and so dhamma is the word that includes everything, from conditions to the unconditioned. It's a word that means everything and nothing. So we don't have a word that is comparable in the English language. That's why we have to use Dhamma, the word, take the word Dhamma itself. Or Dharma in the Sanskritic form. So all Dhamma is not self. Anatta. And then say the one who grasps this idea thinks that the Buddha said all, there's no self is a kind of categorical statement that Buddhists believe in. This is like, you know, what misinterpretations of Buddhism tend to proclaim. Buddhism is a negative teaching because it talks about suffering and no self. And it sounds negative if you're looking at it in terms of kind of categorical statements and doctrines that you're supposed to accept as kind of a foundation for your practice, is what you have to believe in these particular statements. But these statements are for contemplation. So that's why when we say sape sankaranicca, we contemplate sankara, anicca, all conditions are impermanent, all dhamma is not self. What does that really mean? As far as I'm concerned, as far as this creature here, this being sitting here that I call me. How does that, how, what is sape tama anatta as in regards to my own experience of life? So you're taking these reflective statements and then contemplating them in terms of your own experience, your own insight. So, for example, there's all kinds of dhammas, aren't there? Everything's a dhamma. There's the dhammas, there's kusala dhamma, akusala dhamma, apiyakata dhamma, sukaya vedanaya sampayutta dhamma, tukaya vedanaya sampayutta dhamma, atukha matsukaya vedanaya sampayutta dhamma, vipaka dhamma, and so forth. You know that chant we do, the Matiga chants at funerals? See, that's people that don't understand what they say, all they hear is dhamma, 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 dhamma. Kusala dhamma, kusala dhamma, payagata dhamma, sukhaya vedanaya sampayuddha dhamma. Me, the dhamma. There's only the dhamma. All kinds of dhammas. All dhammas are not self. But this dhamma also, there's the dhammas and then there's the dhamma. The conditions and the unconditioned is not self. And what does that mean? And knowing how the human mind tends to want to grasp, say, even the idea of a self in regards to, like say the ultimate of any religious goal is oftentimes we think of it in terms of like a god or god which tends to become a kind of person in our mind, like most of us have been brought up in Christian families or influence of Christianity or Judaism in our lives, and therefore this idea of God usually is something we all have as a person, personal God, a father, a patriarch. And then we're children of God. So this is symbolism, though, isn't it? Is that to be taken kind of literally? Do Christians mean that absolutely literally? Or is it also pointing beyond itself? Because when you get into mysticism, then you're using a different mental ability, isn't it? It's more intuitive rather than definitive. The Buddha avoided using a personification or anthropomorphic imagery for ultimate reality. Amata Dhamma, the deathless. But that sounds negative too, deathless. Or is that a double negative? It could be a positive, isn't it? If death is negative, that would be a positive. But it sounds negative. Deathless, immortal, truth. But it's a very abstract thing. It doesn't have a thing of saying that pulls on the heart, isn't it? It's merely a concept, an abstract concept. So what is that in terms of our own direct experience, the deathless? Because it's pointing to here and now, to that which we can know directly, isn't that it's not deathlessness is some kind of idea or something far away or something difficult to you know, so minute or so subtle. Maybe it's not subtle at all. Maybe it's so obvious we're just not aware. We've never seen it, like the fish in the water doesn't know what water is. Because human ignorance is the strong identification with what is not self. We are identified with the body. My body. Don't touch my body. It's mine. Well, my thoughts, my feelings, my life. And we're very convinced that this is what we are. These mortal conditions, these death-bound conditions are me. Now that's the assumption, that's the logic of that assumption, that if I am the five khandhas, then I'm going to die. Because all these are constantly dying. Mental states are coming and going all the time, being born and dying. The body was born so many years ago and it will die in the future. But feelings and sanya, sankhara, they're always up and down, coming, going, birth and death. And yet our ignorance can really hold on to these, because we can remember things so well, we have a retentive memory, we can hold on to views, static views, or perceptions of ourself that we can hold, that maybe we form when we're a child, and we hold on to that idea that I'm this way till we die at 120. And some people can just, you know, you get some image of yourself, some perception of yourself, maybe when you're a little innocent child, and you hold on to that perception till you die at the age of 120. That's possible. People do that. People, you know, you can really see when somebody dies how people hold on to things. If you've been with people who are dying, you know how they hold on. They oftentimes you can see unresolved karma, unresolved fears and attitudes come up in their consciousness before they die and frighten them. They don't know how to cope with it because maybe their whole life they've just operated with these wrong views, interpreted life, and experienced life through all these distortions. So for some people, the death process can be terrifying because it's the stuff is going to come into consciousness, whether you like it or not, unless you dope yourself up so completely that you're just not conscious. So in meditation, it's like a dying. You know, what we're doing now is we're learning how to die. And that might sound a bit morbid to most people, but we're by opening the mind and the heart to the way it is, then we're releasing ourselves from this basic delusion, this avicca. So then, to me, it seems very, very, by doing this as we go along through life, by the time we die, then what's there to let go of? You've already done the work. So it's a more like a fulfillment of a life. Now, I like to think of death as like fulfillment, the last great experience as an individual, the death moment, rather than a kind of failure or an ugly thing that we have to experience at the end of our lives. Maybe it's one of the greatest experiences we have yet to have. If you think of it like that. I think it's probably more like that if you're if you've lived your life properly and you've learned from it, then death is a liberation, is a the final death. It's a joyful experience rather than a miserable one. Anyway, I'll tell you when I die. See if I can come back and communicate what it's like. You'd probably be frightened, I think. Ghost of Ajahn Sumedho. But it does make sense if you're moving to the deathless in this life. I mean, if you're beginning to recognize or realize that. And then the Buddha's teaching is very direct, isn't it? Mindfulness is the path to the death, is the way to the deathless. Mindfulness is the key word, isn't it? And in that statement in the Dhammapada, appamado amattapadang, appamado is heedlessness. Appamada is a Pali word, meaning heedless, not being heedless. Now heedless is being attached to all the dying things. They pamado machu no padang. Pamado is appamado is heedlessness heedfulness. To be heedful and to be aware. Yeah. To be aware, to be mindful, to be heedful is the way to the deathless, and that's in the present moment. So when we are paying attention, when we are listening, watching, paying attention, being heedful, then what is that? Ask yourself. Not to try to grasp anything, but to more or less trust in that, in that attentive state of being in the moment. To find your refuge in being aware, attentive, heedful of the way it is. And it doesn't matter how it is then. It's not saying it has to be good or bad or whatever. It's just this way. Play as kusala dhamma, akusala dhamma, pyakata dhamma, and so forth. It's some things are skillful, some things unskillful, some things are neither skillful nor unskillful, some things are pleasurable, some things are painful, some things are neither pleasurable nor painful, like this. So that the conditions are changeable and variable in the present, but that which is heedful is your refuge. And then also recognize the strong emotional attachments we have to pleasure and to trying to get rid of pain what is unpleasurable. So you find yourself, emotions arising while you're sitting in meditation, feeling angry or averse to this, or bored or restless, or just negative towards this and negative towards that. That's emotional, but that also is impermanent. And we can be aware of our emotional reactions to the pain in the body or the memories or emotions that we happen to be experiencing in the present. So when we begin to trust and abide and rest in this attention, in this, just this, relax into it, that's why I keep using, rather trying to find it as something, which always means we're we're putting forth an effort looking for something to find it as an object. You can't find it as an object, you can only be that. So relax and pay attention. And see that meditation is resting, relaxing in an attentive way, paying attention. Not the idea of attention on something, you know, like you don't make yourself concentrate on something, but just that state of attention as it is in a, where it's not looking for anything, but there is this clarity and attentiveness in the moment. And that's why I found the sound of silence a helpful sign too, because it, if you can recognize that, it helps to kind of give you something to relax with into that silence. And learn to just trust in kind of sustaining for little bits at a time. Don't be too ambitious and think I'm going to do it for a whole hour and something like that, because then we get eager, we get greedy, we want to, you know, have the big breakthrough, and all these kind of things tend to blind us again to practice, to what we're actually doing. So this is to the practice of meditation is always a very humbling experience, because our egos can't really make it work for us. When we're trying to make ourselves meditate from avijja, it doesn't work. It's always going to be a flop of some sort, some disappointment. So, this resting, relaxing, doesn't mean you crash down onto the floor, you can sit, but you're learning how to sit and in a relaxed way, and just trust in this attentiveness. As we're not trained to do this. We always want to think about it or find something or do something. So we can be aware of this, the kind of restless reactions we have to this kind of practice of wanting to have something to do, get full of doubts because we start thinking about it all. We're just overcome by doubt, restlessness, and or sleepiness or torpor-ness. Pamado machinopadang, and heedlessness is like dying, is the same as death. Heedlessness is death. Heedfulness is immortality. And this is, don't believe this. I'm just, these are, this is the, from the Dhammapada, a verse from the Dhammapada, but it is for contemplation. So we contemplate the deathless. What is that in my own experience? And the death, what is that? It's not just, don't wait till the body dies, but what is death as an experience that we have in daily life? The loss, the ending. So that then the mind in the state of reflective awareness, attentiveness, is contemplating what the body, the feelings, the conceptions, consciousness, the five aggregates, the six ayatanas, the eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, and mind, mental, the brain. So we notice the eye and the object of the things that we see and the contact, how this is the experience of consciousness through the eye, through the ear, through the nose, through the tongue, through the body. And then the manovijnana, the mental consciousness that thinks with thought and perception of the objects of that memory, perception, thought, or feeling, the emotions. We can be aware of any emotion we might be experiencing just by paying attention, by contemplating it. So that which is aware, that which contemplates, that which can ponder, for easy reference, we call that refuge in the Buddha. That's the Buddha ability of Buddha to know the Dhamma. So you're now realizing Buddha and Dhamma. And then Sangha we can say we're Sangha, but we can't go around saying we're Buddha. Because Sangha is allowing for us as individual human beings, the Supatipanno, Ujjupatipanno, Yayapatipanno, Samijipatipanno, those who practice in the right way, with insight, with integrity, in a direct way. The Sangha, this word patipanno means putting into practice, doing it. It's not just a group of scholars thinking about Buddhist philosophy. The Supatipanno is one who's actually doing it, making it work, practicing this way. Sangha as a refuge then is also a skillful reflection to say, be able to let go of our own individual self-centered attachment, because Sangha means it includes all of us, isn't it? We're Sangha. It's a belonging to a community, a group, a church. Of human beings, men and women like ourselves. So it's not the Sangha, say, as you practice more and more, is a more kind of inspiring refuge, and one that we really appreciate, because the sense of oneself falls away. The need to be an individual, a personality, to assert oneself as a person, that kind of isolation, alienation, loneliness that comes from identification with yourself in these very separative ways, suddenly it doesn't make any more sense. That's not really how things are. That's how they seem, but that's not how they really are. So then the Sangha is more the reality. We've sense belonging to a Sangha. We're refuge in the Sangha. Supatipanno, Ujjupatipanno, Yayapatipanno, Samijipatipanno. So as social beings, human beings that live, still a living, breathing, conscious creatures on this planet, our refuge is in practicing in the right way, in moral integrity, in honesty, in all that is fine in the human experience that is praiseworthy, true and real. Where that's our refuge, to speak in the right way, not to lie, not to abuse, not to exaggerate, not to gossip, to use our bodies in the right way, not to harm other creatures. To respect each other and to encourage the good and the true and to encourage each other towards practice, towards liberation, rather than, say, pulling each other back out of emotional needs and desires. We try to support each other's aspiration, each other's practice. In a celibate community too, isn't it? We're men and women living together, monks and nuns, anagarikas and anagarikas. We're living together as sangha. And so then we're helping each other towards that realization of nibbana, rather than trying to form personal attachments or trying to develop dependencies on this person or that person, or fascinations or attractions between a male and female, and so forth. We're determined not to do things like that, not to try to influence people toward anything less than encouraging them toward their spiritual realization. Sounds very high-minded indeed, but it is very inspiring to think that we can do that, because so much of society is doing the opposite, isn't it? Pulls you back into the worries, the problems, the personal needs, the intimidations, the infatuations, the problems of worldly life. In our life together, of course, we learn from each other all the time, so that we find we like this one better than that one, or we feel a particular affinities with this person and not with that one, or we feel attracted to this one and repelled by that one, and we have the usual reactions that human beings have in the worldly life. But now we're using it for practice of Dhamma rather than believing it in terms of personal opinion and personal attachment. Example, if I were trying to draw people to me as a person, to attach to me as a person, or then that would be a betrayal of this sense of sangha. It's to try to encourage people towards their spiritual goal that one, say, feels responsible. And one's joy lies in encouraging people towards the practice of meditation, towards developing a sense of responsibility for one's own life and actions and speech, and toward that refuge in Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, rather than in emotional attachments or personal attachments that sometimes can be very compelling and very, convincing, but as being very important. But when I really contemplate in Dhamma and reflect upon it, I see that that would be, very, very wrong thing to be doing, to try to influence people for any selfish motives of my own. So the refuge, like this is not a guru-oriented group either. In Theravada Buddhism, it's not. If you notice, it doesn't have any real gurus. We have ajahns and teachers and that. But I mean, there's not guru worship as such. It's not based on the personal qualities of any monk or nun or teacher as being what you should take refuge in. It's this respect for the Dhamma Vinaya, for the teaching and the practice that the Buddha left us, that we say hold up for people as that which they take refuge in, rather than in this guru or this ajahn. Now that doesn't mean that we don't have charismatic qualities, or people can get very emotionally attached or fixed on some monks or nuns. That's possible, but and that's fair enough too if that's what's happening. But the encouragement is toward a realization of Dhamma rather than towards a fixation on a person. And in the Theravada tradition, another very good thing I like very much is that there isn't any. I mean, even if you go see the Sangharaja of Thailand, he looks pretty much like this. Where's the Sangharaja? They don't wear crowns or especially unusually kind of magnificent brocaded robes. Even the highest monk in Thailand, the Sangharaja, is robe something like this. It doesn't look much different from this one. And so if you're not pointing to the, I mean, the Theravada Sangha, the monastic Sangha, is pretty much uniform. It's not, is has variations in the kind of color of your robes. The city monks used to wear orange, and the forest monks used to wear this mucky color, ochre, muddy color, and now the muddy colors become fashionable. Even the Bangkok bhikkhus are wearing muddy brown robes, and the bright orange ones, not so many these days. But these are just the variations of color, but the robe is pretty much the same thing. So you can see the one-pointedness of this style, where the Buddha, the Dhamma, the Sangha is a refuge. The teaching is available to us all equally. Is that there's not a special teaching for monks and a special teaching for nuns or anagarikas. They get a lesser teaching than the bhikkhus or the lay people. Lay people are hopeless. They can only have a lay teaching that is definitely below the standard of the high teaching that we give the bhikkhus. You'll get the same teaching. And anyone who asks can get the teaching. You know, you'll have to, you know, not just the special friends of Ajahn Sumedho or just the, you know, a select group, but anyone who comes and asks, you give them the teaching. So you see, it's not a teaching, it's not a secret society or it's not a teaching based on just on special, for special groups or classes or that the Dhamma for men is different than the Dhamma for women. We're transcending all of that, all these divisive conditions, all the Dhammas, to realize the Dhamma, the truth of the way it is. Now, admittedly, it's so simple that it's difficult. when you look at being simple is the most difficult thing for us. Complicated things are much more easy for us. You'd probably be, some of you are much better at computers than at meditation. Really complicated things like computers. I don't know anything about computers, but they look very complicated. And, I'm too stupid to be able to run a computer. I'm computer illiterate. Am I bragging or what? But anyway, but the Dhamma is ultimate simplicity. Seeing that to know the difference, to be able to discern between the death, between that which is death and that which is deathless. And it isn't a matter of thought, is it? It is this attentive watching and listening, paying attention. And listening to the subtleties of and of both what you experience externally through the senses and what goes on inside you. It's all that is, all sape sankara anicca, all conditions are impermanent. Sape tamanata, all dhamma is not self. And as I've said before, you don't have to find yourself. You just, it's not a matter of having to find yourself. Just let go of everything that you think you are. It's letting go of everything that's not yourself, that you think is yourself. That is called avijja, isn't it? Avijja is this ignorance that we're attached to. We think we're all kinds of things that we're not. We assume all kinds of things that are not true. So the awakened one, the one who knows, is it like the one who knows the world? This is Buddha, knows the Dhamma, and the Sangha is the one that practices the Dhamma. So I offer this for your reflection and contemplation this evening. Mm-hmm.